Working. So I've changed my title. I don't remember what it used to be, but now I'm going to talk about the evolution of multicellular complexity. Here's an example of a multicellular organism. Here's a bunch more. The reason, or a reason, that biologists are interested in multicellular complexity is not because of an in-principle thing. We're interested in it because it's proven to be an avenue for adaptation and diversification. And that's why many ecologists and evolutionary biologists are interested in multicellular complexity, demonstrated here. It's not only demonstrated with current diversity, it's been the case for a long time, something on the order of a billion years, not quite. And it's not only true for organisms that we can see with the naked eye or are quite large, it's true for organisms that Rick talked about a little while ago, and things that are so small we can't really see them very well. So multicellularity has been a major mode for adaptation and diversification. If we look at the eukaryotic tree of life, which is here, most of which I have no idea what these organisms really are, a large number have at least one multicellular species in it. And Rick and others have noted that there are at least 25 transitions to multicellularity. And this is not exactly so obvious why. If multicellularity was an innovation, why did it happen 25 times? Why wasn't it just once? If it's so great, why didn't we get a sweep of multicellularity from a single lineage? So that's my first big question that I like to have the answer to. The second is represented here, and Rick earlier showed basically the same slide about the diversification and the evolution of complexity of Volvox there. It's still really pretty, just like Rick showed. It's Matt's work. And if you have any questions about this, don't ask me. Ask Matt or Rick or somebody else, because I don't know what they really did. But this is what I find interesting. So this is a relative of ours. It's a mammal-like reptile. And it's just about as old as this diversification, something around the size of a dog. Now, this is kind of weird. Why are we getting this diversification if we've already got things that are as complicated as a dog running around? Not quite a dog, but our ancestors. So not only were there multiple origins of multicellularity, it's still an ongoing process. Is the evolution of multicellularity happening as we speak in this room, out there someplace? Not exactly obvious as to why that would be, at least from an evolutionary ecologist's perspective. No thing that I'd like to have an answer to. The third big question, just for this morning, I'd like to have the big answer to, is why multicellularity, why complexity evolved. So here's something that's familiar to anybody who's taught evolution to. It's the freshman physics version of biology. The process of evolution by natural selection. I'm not going to go through it, other than to say the theory of natural selection does not predict increases in complexity. It predicts fitness will increase in the short term. And we see many lineages that haven't changed over long periods of time, but some have increased and become more complex. So if you read the literature, you'll read a lot of interesting hypotheses, like complexity itself is adaptive. So we have, why were there multiple origins if multicellularity is so great? Why is it still happening now, possibly? Is it still going on? And how, if it's not directly predicted, or if it's not an outcome that we necessarily expect from natural selection? So I'm not going to say really anything about one and two. I'm not sure if we're going to get the answers to one and two anytime soon, but I think they're big questions that we haven't really totally addressed here, but I think they are important questions. I'm going to talk a little bit about three and some work that's been going on in my lab. And the approach that we take that I take and some of my colleagues take is a kind of natural engineering. And what we do, it's experimental evolution. Instead of manipulating the genes directly, we put organisms that we're interested in under some selection scheme and look how they respond to that. So we've tested how repeatable adaptive diversification is. In Paul's lab, wherever Paul Rainey is, we looked at adaptive radiation, we looked at hybrid speciation, we looked at some social interactions in yeast, and how spatial structure can cause a collapse in diversity. And the reason that this works is because we have huge population sizes that we often work with. And natural selection is really powerful when you have big population sizes of things like yeast. So the natural thing for us to do was, if we were interested in multicellularity, is to experimentally evolve it. So we took big populations of yeast and put them under a selection scheme that I'll describe in a moment, and we had 10 replicate populations initially, all started from the same ancestor, which looks kind of like that, and we got these 10 different kinds of multicellularity out, or it looks very similar. This is all work that that myself and Will Ford Dennison and Mark Barillo worked on. Will did directly or directed others the experimental aspects of this. So if you have any real questions, you can probably ask Will. I'll attempt to answer them, but we'll see how it goes. So this is what our yeast looks like after we've done the selection scheme. So this is our blurry first movie. If you know anything about yeast or even microorganisms in general, this doesn't really look like how a microorganism divides. You don't have a single cell. It kind of buds off another cell. It separates and separately buds off and get a whole bunch of single cells. Instead, we get a whole bunch of these things that we thought looked like snowflakes, and so that's what I'll call them throughout the rest of this talk. So how did we get there? So what was our big selection scheme that we took? It's very difficult to do this experiment. We grew up yeast over 24 hours in an incubator at a controlled temperature. We took a sample of that and put it in a microcentrifuge tube, and we centrifuged it on the lowest speed that our microcentrifuge would work at for 10 seconds. We threw almost all of it away, took the last little bit, we put it into a new tube that we replaced back in the incubator. So this selection scheme is almost as simple as you could possibly do a microbial selection experiment. It's slightly more difficult than the one that we used in Rich Lenski's lines, in that we actually did a centrifugation. It's slightly more difficult than the stuff that Paul will talk about following me, where we actually did some centrifugation in the Rainey experiments. Well, we just grow them on the bench. So this is the mode by which we did the selection, and this is the response that we saw. So we propagated these 10 replicate populations for about 60 days, 60 transfers. And after 15 minutes, if you take single cell yeast and you put them in a tube like that, and you wait for them to settle, 15 minutes later, not much happens. After 7 transfers, still not much happens. After that, you see that a lot of the yeast gets to the bottom. And by 60 transfers, after 15 minutes, 60 transfers of selection, 15 minutes, all the yeast are at the bottom of the tube, by and large. So this is our response to selection. Now, there's two, broadly speaking, two ways that we could have got a response to selection. One of which, we could have got gigantic cells. The other, multicellularity. So we were betting we were going to get a form of multicellularity. That was our expectation. But we thought it's possible we could get giant cells, although we had some anticipation that we might get some, there'd be deleterious consequences of having a giant cell. We did, in fact, see giant cells. So just getting a bigger cell means you fall through the media faster. So this is our experiment. So we directly selected on essentially the ability to settle through media. We got a response to selection that we got bigger organisms that fell through the media faster. We saw some evolution of bigger cell sizes, but in all the populations, we saw multicellularity arise. At least cells were attached to one another. So earlier, Dave sort of talked about what one might think of as an organism, and sort of definitional aspects, or at least try to think about how organisms, one might think about organisms and multicellularity. And I'm not going to try and parse it out so well, other than to say that there are some characteristics that people think are associated with multicellularity, even though not everybody agrees what they might be. So physical adhesions of cells, that you have multicellular life history, that there's some reproduction associated with it, juvenile adult life history stages, a life history that responds to selection, and division of labor among cells. And I'll talk about some of these today. So yesterday, and maybe today, we talked about there's sort of two modes for the evolution of multicellularity. One is kind of coming together, where you have separate cells that kind of come together and form a multicellular individual. Here's a image from one of Dave's papers from 2008. And yeast do this. Yeast can do that. It can be sort of sticky. They have extracellular bits that kind of stick to one another. And people have seen this before, Foster in particular. And another approach is that, and this is what, in fact, what we saw, instead of cells gluing to one another, these are, in our case, we see daughter cells stay attached to their mother cells. So instead of being coming together, essentially what we saw are staying together. And we know this for two ways, one of which is that they form bud scars where cells are attached. So here we can see this cell is attached to this one, which is attached to that one, and so on. And the second, you can take an individual or individual snowflake and break it down with an enzyme so that you get the individual component cells, or at least one or two cells, and then you can watch them grow up. So you can see each of these individuals here arose from one or two cells, and they're not growing by sticking. They're not becoming snowflakes because they're sticking to one another. They're becoming snowflakes because the individual cells are staying attached. The daughter cells are staying attached to mother cells. And we have an actual mechanism for how this works. ACE2 is exported to the mother nucleus. From the mother nucleus and localized in the daughter cell nucleus, it activates some other regulators, which then affect endochitinase. So ACE2 is a trans-acting regulator that has downstream regulatory effects that affects an endochitinase. So it's a very reasonable, nice hypothesis, and we're working on demonstrating this right now. Right, so knocks out the endochitinase, no endochitinase, daughter cell doesn't separate. Five of the populations we see this, the other five, we actually don't know what's going on. So are these really multicellular? We think they are. So do they have physical adhesion between cells? Yes, they do. Do they have a multicellular life history? Do they have reproduction? So here's a close-up, a much better movie that Will took later on of a multicellular reproduction. And you can see that the daughter and snowflake sort of pop off. There's twins right there. Parental ones. Let's see that again. But this time you'll see what happens. You'll be able to watch the transition, the birth events, right there. You'll note that the offspring. You see asymmetry in the parent and the offspring size. It doesn't divide in two. What sets the size? Yes. We know a little bit, but not everything about that. And I'll get to a little bit of that. But most of that, we'll talk about on Friday. That's just because that we take this image over many hours and the drop, it's a half microliter drop, starts to dry down. So here's one cluster, and after about 300 minutes, so hours there, it divides. And for a particular genotype, we'll see a characteristic size for reproduction. Below the size, you don't get reproduction. So it kind of has a juvenile and adult stages. Until you get to this big, you don't get reproduction. And if that's true, then perhaps we should be able to select on it. And that would fit with the levels of selection argument that Smith and Szasmari made a few years ago now. So how would that work? So here we have a unicellular ancestor. We selected for the snowflake cluster phenotype. And you could see that different snowflakes had different sizes. And presumably, if this is an individual, in the sense that Rick was talking about earlier, we should be able to select on these differences and see that natural selection acts on that phenotype. So to place them into the kind of image, our actual phenotypes, this is what we expect, perhaps, that we'll be able to get adaptation at this cluster level. So how did we do this? So we actually did this. How did we do it? So the way we did it was we went back, because these are yeast, and you can go back into the freezer and get out the 30 transfer guys, not the 60 transfer guys. This is after they'd made the transition to multicellularity. So we have a population that's made the transfer to multicellularity. And we put them under different selective regimes. One, a 5-minute settling regime. So we put them on a bench for 5 minutes and took whatever got to the bottom. So this is pretty tough selection. They don't get to the bottom in 5 minutes, into the autoclave. Then a slightly more benign selection. They have 15 minutes to get to the bottom of the tube, or if they're in the autoclave. And a very benign, nice, easy 25, lazy, you can get float down, take a while to get to the bottom of the tube before you get into the autoclave if you don't make it. So we did that selection for 35 rounds, and this is what we saw. The genotypes that were evolved under 25 minutes, the weak selection, if you assay how fast they settle to the bottom of a tube after 7 minutes, about half of them get to the bottom, and slightly more for the individuals that were selected for 15 minutes. But the ones that were only given 5 minutes to get to the bottom of the tube, they settle much better. They responded to selection. How did they do it? So 25-minute settling over there, 5-minute settling selection over here. These guys are big. Those ones are small. We selected for body size directly, or sort of indirectly. So these ones stay big. Those ones, they can be small. And the reason is small ones grow faster because of diffusion, and big ones grow slower. But if you don't get to the bottom of the tube and you're big, it doesn't matter if you're big. You have to get to the bottom of the tube. You have to be big, get to the bottom. So if you... We haven't done that, but we could do that. We've done some other things that I won't get a chance to talk to you about, but we haven't. So fast-settling ones are big. Slow-settling ones are small. And this is a really divergent selection. So here, the 25-minute settling ones, they actually decreased in the size, and the 5-minute settling ones got bigger. So this was the first 60, 65 rounds of selection. We see that the life history not only responds to selection, we can get divergent selection, we get all the kinds of things that people who work with big organisms typically see, the evolution of body size, the evolution of adult life history trade-offs that we'll actually talk about more. So do we see division of labor? Many people are interested in division of labor among cells. The answer is yes, but you'll have to wait till Friday to hear about more. So the questions about multicellularity. I'm not going to say anything about one or two, but three, well, natural selection doesn't directly affect complexity. One mode of adaptation was become multicellular. You could become gigantic, but presumably there are deleterious consequences to this. So, and we found single nucleotide polymorphisms that improve your ability to get to the bottom of the tube, which the mechanism by which they is because they became multicellular. So the chicken and egg problem that we heard about yesterday and we heard a little bit more about today, we don't have a chicken and egg problem, at least in our system. Right? You Selection operates perfectly just like we always thought it did. You don't have to hypothesize new mechanisms or new complexities. We might have to expand our way of thinking about how selection operates, but there's nothing paradigmatically new that's required. Natural selection, in and of itself, is sufficient. So we've done a little bit of modeling about the nature of cell shape and size within them, and clearly we do see that evolves. It makes you think a little bit about what one means about differentiation. Does it have to be terminal or not? So clearly not, because most of these cells they're still reproductive, but they have different shapes. So that the sort of continuum that Dave talked about there's a continuum as well within an individual as well as sort of nature of organisminality.
So I think your selection is kind of interesting. So there's been this long-term idea that maybe multicellularity might be inevitable due to cell size restrictions on surface area. I wonder if that's not what you're recapitulating just by the selective pressure, perhaps. I know in climate modus, for example, there is a definite hard limit of 1,200 cubic microns. You can't do it. They go kaput after that.
So if I understand,
they have to divide after.
Right. If I understood your question, then yes, I would say that's consistent with our observation. Although I don't know anything about the hard limit for yeast size. I know that tetraploids, which is what we probably have, are gigantic, and we haven't tried to make an octoploid yet.
So they are polyploid.
Yeah.
Mostly. And then, so kind of related to that, have you tried doing the selection on any of the known yeast cell size regulators? They've been kind of curious if they seem to select for, if you have something that's already a large cell mutant, if it'll start going to the snowflake formation versus.
So those are good questions, and I probably won't be able to answer them all in sufficient detail. So in the populations that we have ones that evolved snowflake first. We have ones that evolved big cells and small cells that had some that actually were both maintained in at least one of them, and then they both subsequently evolved snowflakes. So we have big ones that have large cell snowflakes and small cell snowflakes. We have both of them. We have all.
So basically, they solve both paths.
Yes,
going large
right.
cell first, then
that's
snowflake,
right.
and snowflake.
Yep.
Cool.
So I was just, excuse me, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. So this is another question. Have you thought, or is anyone doing this, trying to evolve unicells from different multicellular organisms?
Yes, so we're doing it. Let's see, do I have it here? There's that. So we've tried that. Let's see, I'm not sure if I have it or if I just deleted it. So we're doing it with cyano as well, with cyanobacteria. We very quickly we notice two things. You can evolve different giant cyano clumpy things. So, you know, that we're using Anabina. And now we've gotten heterocysts that have more than two non-heterocyst cells adjacent to them. So we have, at least we think we have a heterocyst that in fact looks like it's got a two pair of cells off of it. So we are pursuing that.
So just, two things. With regards to the Clemmy experiments, so which of the species was it? Was it Reinhardtii? So, did you observe a difference in the size in cells, in the unicellular and in the groups, or doesn't that matter?
I don't think we observed a big difference in cell size.
In size.
No.
And also the other thing I just wanted to check is that if you stress many of the Clemmy species, they form these palmoloid.
Yes, so these guys, they don't seem to have that response. I mean, so it might be that they've co-opted a stress response, but under these conditions, the ancestor and the other replicates that we have don't do this. So it's clearly, I can't remember what the fancy term is. It would be a co-option of a phenotypic plasticity of this, which could be something like that, although we're not sure.
Did you measure the probability distribution of the number of cells in each of the snowflakes?
Probability distribution.
In other words, all the snowflakes have the same number of cells, right?
Oh, no.
So they have a, so, they, so there's a
no,
distribution
they
number.
So not
did you measure that?
Okay, so we've, I probably won't be able to answer the question exactly the way you'd like. I'm gonna try to completely understand it. But if you take a single isolate, single genotype, and you grow it up again, they won't form exactly, not even remotely exactly, an adult size, right? So.
Sure.
So, I mean, there was a range there. So that was a genotype that I showed.
Right. So if you just took a snapshot of your system after a certain amount of time and you measured, you know, how many have got 20 cells or 30 cells or 25 cells or whatever,
yeah,
called a frequency distribution, did you measure that?
Yeah, we've done that. Yes, we've done
that. That's your paper, so I'd be interested to know what that is. Cause that
so
was
so we, all right, so I'm, okay, so we've done some of that. I would say that we've, this probably doesn't answer your question, but it was interesting to us, that we observed this a demographic, right? So that if we were growing up our populations, we had to start them up again, so not just sort of from the freezer, we actually had to start them up again and re-acclimate them demographically, so not just genetically, so to get them to be more at whatever equilibrium would be, because otherwise they would, in fact, do different things, so which we've had to do with other microorganisms previously, but under much more unusual conditions. This is just taking them out of the freezer. We had to actually get them demographically. The population structure had to re-equilibrate with the selective conditions that we were growing them under. So we didn't want them all young or all old, so to speak.
Did you try to de-evolve the multicellular back into unicellular by just selecting the opposite selection?
You can, but it's very hard. It took them forever. It took them forever to do that, and we had to produce pretty strong selection to get them to stop being multicellular. So they get smaller, but to get them back to unicell was not trivial. They didn't, the reverse selection didn't rapidly lead to loss of multicellular. They became small. You can evolve them to become smaller, but to get them to back to unicell wasn't instantaneous, at least in the lineage that we did it.
Do you understand how the clumps divide? Like, are there obvious sort of weak points and they just break off?
Yeah, it's the break point, basically. So initially, we think that it's just stress across individual cells. It's obviously genotype specific in ways that we don't fully understand.
Over here. So I have a question, so kind of related to that one. So if you take your snowflake clusters that are, you're probably growing them in rich media?
Yes.
And so if you wanted to revert them, so what if you stress them by growing them in like very low nutrients and make them start having to actually compete for resources? The prevailing hypothesis would be, since they're not autotrophs, they should disperse.
Yeah, they
but
don't.
Maybe not. I don't know what selective pressure would cause them to revert.
Yeah, so these are grown in rich media. If you put them in poor media, they definitely change. So it might have been, the big clumps, so even in rich media, right, if you're a big clump, you grow slower, and there's no question about it. It's completely related to the size, so it's better to be smaller. Seemingly, there is a size below which the benefit is just declines quite a bit. And it's because they don't actually form a size, right, there's a gradient of size, the selection coefficient, as you push them to be smaller and smaller, the benefit that you get out of being a unicellular declines more and more, because
So you're
already small anyway, right?
Because you don't have a set size, you're trying to move a distribution.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yes.
So I think you sort of, back here.
Yeah.
So you sort of just answered the question I was going to ask, but I'm sort of surprised by the answer. So I was going to ask if there was an increase in growth rate of the multicellular clusters.
They grow slower.
They grow
sure.
slower. Because
yes.
So I know the ACE2 mutants tend to grow faster, and
well, maybe at an individual, but no, these guys definitely grow slower. No question about it.
And just another thing, so Greg Lang and Michael Desai, I don't know if you've seen their experiment, but they had 1,000 replicate lines growing in just YPD, and they're selecting for increased growth rate, and in a large, well, I don't know if large, but about 5% of those lines, multicellular clusters arose. So it seems like that in some cases, these things can actually have a faster growth rate.
It could be. I mean, we didn't see that.
One more question.
Could be, yeah. Yep. Yep. So, yeah, so in five of the populations, we see that if you just make this ACE2 mutation, that's sufficient. And so what we thought of, so most of the work that I've done is much more along the lines of let's grow them and see what you get. And that's powerful because selection is really useful to as a filter. I think given that we have half the populations have this particular locus as the target of selection, we're going to spend a little bit more time than typical from my lab to look at that locus. So we're going to do some mutant screens at that locus, generating a variety of mutations at that locus, and see what the consequences are. It's interesting because it's a transregulator. It's interesting that we see, although it could be chance, that we see there's two regions of the locus that seem to have an impact, but it's not general. It's not obvious why that would be. So there's a couple reasons why we'd investigate that. And that's easier to do than to make a whole bunch of populations. But I appreciate if, it may be that when we look at the other populations, we'll get some better idea about how we might do what you suggested. But at the moment, it's unclear how we would pursue that necessarily.
I have maybe a comment, which is while people have studied the high Reynolds number dynamics, hydrodynamics of snowflakes and flakes, I don't know of any work that's looked at the low Reynolds number snowflakes. So I think that's a very interesting problem. I'm not even sure what these wings add or subtract from that. I think it's far from obvious. I think that's very interesting. And also, I should, going back to a comment I think Ray Goldstein made, and also Dave Queller, about scaling and surface versus volume. Snowflakes basically have a surface area which is proportional to their volume. So it's a very different scaling law than volume to the two-thirds. So I think that's another interesting aspect of what you're presenting.
So I would say that we've gotten a lot more interested in how things fall through media than we would have initially. It turns out to be way more complicated, and we know it's way more complicated, not partly because we've seen it. And there's two ways we've seen it. One is that so Will's rigged up this kind of what he calls a velociometer. He watches them fall through the media. And you can see the ones that are big pushing out the small ones. So there's a kind of interference that they're interacting directly in the environment. And essentially, that gets back to the question you were getting at. Because it changes essentially the viscosity of the media in some macroscopic sense. And so there's continued selection to become big because your neighbor is big. And so how you fall through the media really just in a sort of way that maybe only a biologist would say.
I also say that viscosity isn't everything, especially at low Reynolds number.
You can change
the viscosity and have absolutely no effect.
How they fall through.
I think we better stop it here. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.